Hi, ladies and gentlemen. We had a brief technical problem today that I just wanted to inform you about to prevent a barrage of emails. About 12 minutes in, we got a couple minutes of static, and then it goes away once we get to the Lawrence Lessig interview. I blame Dorsey. He has some type of weird electrical charge. We're trying now to deionize him as we speak. So I just wanted to let you know, hopefully it won't be too distracting for you, but know that it's just a brief 2 or 3 minute period of time where you'll hear that crackle, and then it gets all cleaned up after that. Enjoy the show.
You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Seder. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Seder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Wednesday, March 9th, 2011. My name is Sam Seder, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Quite a show for you today. Lawrence Lessig, the Harvard Law professor, former board member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, one of the founding members of Creative Commons, the next step into the world of copyright, and associated with FixCongressFirst.org, will be joining us. Just a programming note, I had anticipated an interview with the director of Wasteland, an amazing documentary that was nominated for an Academy Award. I actually did that interview, and we will play it on Friday because we had a late-breaking booking with Lawrence Lessig. Did not want to move that. And, folks, just a reminder for those many thousands of you who have not yet become members of the Majority Report, every time you become a member, an angel gets their wings. And not a fundamentalist angel, like a secular angel. A secular, well-versed in politics angel gets its wings. And you allow this show to continue and to flourish and to get better day by day. Those of you who have been with us since the very beginning know that the sound quality has improved. And that's because we buy things like little breakout boxes and things I don't understand. But we're able to do that, and soon I'll be able to pay Dorsey and Evan some real money to be real producers. Just wearing a T-shirt that says I'm a producer is not enough for them. And so please, your membership supports this program as well as our other means of supporting the show, which you can always check out at majority.fm. Let's jump right in. Interesting story right up front. As you may be aware, Representative Peter King from Long Island, New York, starting hearings this week with on how Muslims are bad, I guess, is really, I don't know what the official title of the hearings are. How Muslims are bad, the radicalization of the Muslim population in America. I don't know what this is supposed to do other than basically paint an entire community with a broad brush, an ugly brush, create more anti-Muslim sentiment. I guess really what it is, it's a political strategy for 2012 at a time where most of the Tea Party members think that Barack Obama is a Muslim or wasn't born in this country, a secret Muslim, a secret alien Muslim, whatever it is, all part of that larger narrative. What the effect it will have, of course, is to make it harder to the extent that there are or is any type of radicalization of Muslim youth in this country, it will make it harder on the Muslim community to police themselves in that respect. And remember, every single, and I don't know the validity of these arrests that the FBI makes. More often than not, it seems like a joke to me, arresting people who are seeking boots and uniforms to take over the American government, whatnot. But every time you read about someone being arrested for plotting to plot or some aspirational so-called terrorist attack on America, it is always because they have been turned in by their community, by people around them who are aware of it. Just like the Ted Kaczynskis, and unfortunately, not so much like the bombers of abortion clinics or assassins of abortion doctors. We know that one of the most famous abortion clinic bombers was basically found a lot of solace in a network of fundamentalists who hid him for years and years. But be that as it may, someone's done a little homework on Peter King and found that he was for terrorism before he was against it.
Surprise, surprise.
The New York Times reports for Representative Peter King as he seizes the national spotlight this week with his bullcrap hearings on the radicalization of American Muslims. Oh, wait a second. I think I added that bullcrap. It is the most awkward of resume entries. Long before he became an outspoken voice in Congress about the secret threat from Muslim terrorism, he was a fervent supporter of a terrorist group, the Irish Republican Army. Quote, "We must pledge ourselves to support those brave men and women who at this very moment are carrying forth the struggle against British imperialism in the streets of Belfast and Derry." Mr. King told a pro-IRA rally on Long Island, where he was serving as Nassau County Comptroller in 1982. Can you imagine? Can you imagine if, say, a Muslim comptroller from a local county got up and said, "We must support and pledge ourselves to support those brave men and women who at this very moment are carrying forth the struggle against Israeli imperialism in the streets of the West Bank." Can you imagine what would happen to that person? Their career would be over. The death threats would not stop. The hours and hours and hours of Fox News dedicated to this man's statement, the hauling out of every single elected official in the country to denounce this person. Yet, now we have the specter of a man like this, Peter King, investigating Muslims for radicalization. He was so aligned with this terrorist group, the IRA, that a judge in Belfast threw him out of an IRA murder trial, calling him an obvious collaborator. What? Was that? I'm sorry. A murder trial? You mean that was not held on the Isle of Man in some secret gulag prison on a military commission? Are you suggesting to me, New York Times, that these Irish terrorists were tried in civil courts? I just don't understand. But as Mr. King prepares Thursday to preside over the House Homeland Security Committee at the first of a series on Muslim radicalization, his pro-IRA past gives many of his critics an obvious opening. Yes, I'd say. The congressman's assertions that 85% of the leaders of American mosques hold extremist views and that Muslims do not cooperate with law enforcement have alarmed Muslim groups, some counterterrorism experts, and even a few former allies in the Irish-American causes. Of comparisons between the terrorism of IRA and that of Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, Mr. King said, quote, "I understand why people who are misinformed might see a parallel. The fact is, the IRA never attacked the United States, and my loyalty is to the United States. So according to Peter King, and I imagine he will be holding this press conference in within moments, he also has no problem with Hamas or Hezbollah or any Palestinian organization that fires Katyusha rockets into Israel. They're not attacking the United States. He's not suggesting that Israel is a closer ally than Britain. I mean, I would assume, let's just say they're equal. This man has no leg to stand on. It's absolutely a farce. It's a farce. And King's exactly right to say there's a difference of approach between the IRA and Al-Qaeda, and I would say that is, yes, there is difference. Says Tom Parker, counterterrorism specialist at Amnesty International and former British military officer, but I personally consider both of them terrorist groups. Of course. Of course. He went on to say, Mr. King said at one point, where is this? He has another wonderful quote. Oh, here it is. King told a pro-IRA rally on Long Island in 1982. I'm sorry, in 1985. If civilians are killed in an attack on a military installation, it is certainly regrettable, but I will not morally blame the IRA for it. Who should be morally blamed for the killing of those civilians? No, because what they did in Peter King's mind was justified. Now, I'm not judging the IRA one way or another. But I'm also not judging the Muslim community in this country. I'm also not saying that 85% of Muslim leaders are in some way extremist or a danger or a threat to this country. What troubles Mr. Parker is that Mr. King understands the pull of ancestral ties. He took a great interest in a terrorist struggle overseas. He's a guy who could bring real insight into the situation. Instead, he is damaging cooperation from the greatest allies the U.S. has in counterterrorism. But, you know, that can't possibly happen. Peter King cannot possibly be that sensible because what he's doing is a charade. And not a Shirley charade. A charade in the sense that what he's doing is completely about drumming up more support from these Tea Partiers who are convinced that Barack Obama is a secret Muslim. There is no other reason. Does he believe that the FBI is not doing a proper job? I mean, is he informing the American public that there's a danger? And what are we supposed to do about that? It's a joke. It's a joke. And this man is a joke. And an idiot. And a liar. And every other epithet I can use without causing this podcast to become explicit. Oh, we should change our explicit, because I'm not going to swear in the first 45 minutes. Well, I did yesterday, didn't I? Did I call somebody an S-head?
Yeah, that happens.
All right, And quickly, before we get to Lawrence Lessig, Politico reported, a group of multinational tech, drug, and energy companies are framing a pitch and preparing a launch of a coordinated campaign on Capitol Hill for a temporary tax break on overseas profits they bring back to the U.S. The so-called repatriation tax holiday could be a tough sell to the public, wary of giving big businesses a free lunch. But Cisco, Oracle, Microsoft, Apple, Qualcomm, Pfizer, Kodak, CA Technologies, Duke Energy, and other proponents believe they have a winning hand and the right people to play it. Of course they have a winning hand. Of course they do. They brought on, as lead lobbyist, former GOP Rep. Jim McRae, ex-ranking member of the House Ways and Means, Jeffrey Forbes, former chief of staff to Senate Finance Chair Max Baucus. Of course they have a winning hand. You know what this tax holiday was called in 2003 when George Bush pushed it? The Create American Jobs Act of 2003. I'm paraphrasing. It was something literally like that. And do you know how many jobs it created? Zero. Zero. The idea is to drop the repatriation tax, which would normally be 35%, to 5%, to allow them to bring their money back and create jobs, research and development. That's the way it was sold to us in 2003. You know what they did with that money when it comes back? They paid their executives more. They gave their shareholders more dividends. They drove up their stock prices. There was no jobs created. In fact, most of those companies ended up cutting jobs. And around page 3 of this article, it gets mentioned that some $315 billion was repatriated during the 2004 holiday, according to IRS data. And there are conflicting accounts of how the money was used. But some studies suggest that much of it went for stock repurchases and dividend payouts, not hiring and domestic spending. Is there some conflicting accounts? Let me guess. The facts and figures show that they spent it on stock repurchases and dividend payouts, but spokespeople from these corporations probably said offhandedly, I'm sure we must have created jobs. And critics also say that another repatriation holiday would create perverse incentive for corporations to shift more U.S. earnings and jobs abroad, knowing that it would just be a matter of time until Congress granted the next tax reprieve. Of course that's the case. That's exactly what happened with the last one. And they, listen, if they think they can do it during a Democratic administration, they certainly know they can do it during a Republican. Will this happen? Probably. Probably. But, you know, we have a huge deficit. We're going broke, don't you know? So why do things like this happen? Why do the rich, why do the corporations get these massive tax breaks and at the same time talk about how the country's going broke? Well, I suspect our next guest, Lawrence Lessig, will have the answer for us. The question is, will he also have the solution on how to end this dynamic? Stick around. We are back on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show Professor Lawrence Lessig. He is a professor at the Harvard Law School. He is a founding member of the Creative Commons. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Great to be here.
So I think the last time we spoke may have been a couple of years ago. I'm sure you don't remember on the old Sam Cedar show. But at that time you had made a significant change in the focus of your work from Creative Commons to fixing what you saw was the major problem that was facing our society, just how our politics were broken. And since that time, I've been following your work, and you've determined it's the influence of money in our politics. Can you take us through that just briefly? The idea that you speak of, the three ideas and of root striking and of independence and of the undermining of trust that we have in our government institutions?
Yeah, let's take it in the reverse order. So 75% of Americans believe money buys results in Washington. Some of them believe that, you know, in the crude sense of bribery, but I think the more sophisticated view is just the influence of money steers members of Congress away from focusing on what they're supposed to focus on, which is what the people want, and instead focusing on what their funders want. That view of 75% of Americans leads most Americans not to trust what Congress does, and many of the people that don't trust therefore disengage. And so when you think about the lack of political participation, at least by anybody, between the two polar extremes, and the distortion of results that we see in what Congress does, you know, it doesn't seem to do either what the Democrats want when the Democrats are in control or what the Republicans want when the Republicans are in control. I think you understand what's at the root of the problems that we face in our government. And what's at the root is the constant obsession of members finding ways to raise money rather than finding ways to do what the people want.
And you know, I saw this talk that you gave at the University of Texas, and you quote Henry David Thoreau that we have hundreds or thousands hacking at the branches of evil to every one striking at the root of it. And so if this money that our political system is bathed in is the problem. And one of the quotes, I think, from that talk you gave was that members develop a sixth sense on how to vote in terms of raising money. What is the solution for this?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that money is the root. You know, people look at particular issues they care about. Could be global warming, could be a simpler tax system. And what they've got to do is connect the dots and recognize we're not going to get any attention to dealing with the global warming issue, or Republicans aren't going to get a simpler tax system until we deal with the money. So to strike at that root, you know, we can't solve the problem by eliminating money from politics, because, you know, politicians need to advertise, they need to tell us why we should vote for them, and we need to know more about why we should vote for them. So instead of eliminating it, what we need to do is to make it so that nobody can believe that money is driving the result. And what that means is to make campaigns driven by small dollar contributions, as opposed to the current world where very large contributions are what candidates and politicians focus on, and therefore they distort their work towards those large contributions. So if we had small dollar elections, and there are a number of proposals out there of how to do it, and in fact we have one presidential candidate on the Republican side now who's pledging to take no more than $100 from anybody and to report every single contribution made, then whenever Congress did something stupid, you know, you might think it's because there are too many Republicans or too many Democrats, but you couldn't believe it was because of the money. And I think that's the essential first step to get us back to a place where we could once again trust this system.
And so you think it's the absence of trust on behalf of the American public that keeps them from involving themselves?
I think a lot, you know, yes. I think there are many people who say, look, I've got kids, I've got hobbies, I've got a job. Why waste my time in this political system when, you know, I really believe that it's not my participation, it's the money that's driving the results. So many people don't engage because of that. But if you removed that excuse and you gave people a reason to believe there were, that something could come from this, and you didn't have the cynical view that we all have when you look at what Washington does, always looking for where the money is driving the result as opposed to what the politicians say they want to do and intend to do, I think we could begin to rebuild from a very low point. You know, the last public trust measure for Congress from Gallup found 11% of the American people had trust in Congress. You know, 11% is an astonishingly low number. There were more people who believed in the British king at the time of the Revolution than who believe in our Congress today. So, you know, this institution is politically bankrupt in the sense of trust in the institution, and it's got a long way to work its way back, but I think the first step is to make it so that we have a reason to trust what they do, or at least trust that they're doing what they do because of reasons and not because of the money.
And how can we get to a situation, and you have a You suggested a model where there would be democracy vouchers, where the first $50 of tax that you pay, you could designate where it would go, and people could raise, candidates could raise $100, and you're actually talking about billions of dollars that would be available to candidates, so that it would still maintain all of the incentive structures, I guess, around the industry of politics, but the money would just be coming from a different place. But how is it that we can actually break? I mean, there's a certain sort of catch 22, right? Or that how do we get politicians who take this pledge? How do we get them elected? Because they're running against guys. I mean, Russ Feingold's a perfect example of somebody who wouldn't take outside money, wouldn't take PAC money, and he got his clock cleaned.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think Russ Feingold's a complicated question. I think he's an extraordinary senator, but I think there's a lot of things that were going on in Wisconsin.
Right. Well, that's true as well.
But I think that, you know, I think we got to begin to think strategically about this issue. You know, if people recognize that money is the problem, like people, like I'm a liberal, I think money is the problem. We got to begin to think about how do we get this to be the issue that candidates are talking about. And so again, I look at a candidate like Buddy Romer in the Republican primaries, and I say, you know, I disagree with all sorts of things Romer believes in. I disagree with his position on choice. I disagree with his position on unions. I think that if the Republican Party were talking openly about eliminating money from the way politics gets decided, that would have an enormous change on the Democratic Party too. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Barack Obama's number one person about this issue at a conference I was at said, you know, he recalled Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who told people, okay, I agree with you, now make me do it.
Right.
And that's what Obama said. I agree with you about the need to get money out of the system, but make me do it. Well, the only way to make Obama do it is to make the Republican Party the number one party arguing we got to get money outside of the system. And I think from the polling we've done that the grassroots Tea Party part of the Republican Party is as upset with Wall Street and corporate influence in our political system as those of us on the left. So here is a place where if we think strategically about how to elevate this to the issue of this campaign, we could open it up for, you know, both sides to begin to talk creatively about how we might make it so that we could once again trust our government.
What do you think about the idea of, and I don't know if any one given idea is any more viable than another from a strategic or a tactical standpoint to get to that point where money has less influence. But one of the big reasons why people raise money is for TV advertising. And theoretically, we still own the public airwaves. So that would mean local stations, not on cable. That would mean broadcast stations. That would mean radio. What if the FCC was to say as part of your license that you need to give free airtime, a certain amount, to politicians 60 days from an election?
Yeah, so that's the way that many other countries around the world solve this problem. You know, that government exerts very strong control over the airways and forces broadcasters to release stuff at a very low price or freely to politicians. The United States is governed by the First Amendment, at least as interpreted by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court's very unlikely to permit the kind of forced access on the public airways. And even if it did, you know, the reality is the public airways are a small chunk of where political campaigning has to happen today. So I would love to have a world where it's easier to get access to the public airways for political speech, but it's not going to solve the problem. I think the root here is to make it so that candidates don't spend their time worrying about a tiny slice of the American public, namely the funders of campaigns, and instead spend their time worrying about the vast majority of people who are supposed to be the deciders in these elections.
And what of the distortion that money brings to our press and just our general understanding of how our government works? I mean, you know, there's clearly an incentive structure and a culture amongst our corporate press that favors money.
Yeah, and I wouldn't call it a culture as much as I would call it, you know, the way the competitive system is working today. And this is an enormously difficult problem. You know, it's very difficult to be balanced and to get audience. And the evidence for that is that, you know, news centers that have moved away from being balanced to being more extreme have found it's much easier to get audience. So if you're Fox News, it doesn't pay to start having a serious debate with people on the left. You know, it pays to put sort of caricatures up of the left up on your screen so that people can laugh at them and feel confident in their right-wing views. Same thing with MSNBC. Makes no sense to be balanced and, you know, sort of have serious conservatives on your show. Much better to kind of ridicule those people and to be very confident about what you're doing. We see the same thing in journalism. You know, Huffington Post, a fantastic collection of news, but framed in a way that's really appealing to the left side of the nation. And that's because the market is driving them to this place. Now, you know, we used to live in a world where there was such a thing called broadcasting. You know, in 1969, 50% of American households every night looked at one of three news shows, right? We're miles from that world today. But when 50% were looking at one of three news shows, those news shows could talk about things that were not niche extreme positions on the right or extreme positions on the left. They had to try to talk to the middle. Now, you know, that is an enormously difficult problem for the democracy to kind of figure out how to work itself through. But I don't see that problem being solved anytime soon because nobody's really figured out how to make money in this way that isn't just trying to appeal to the worst of our extremes in the political system.
But you know, I'd suggest that in those two instances, when you mention Fox and MSNBC or Huffington Post and the Drudge Report or whatever, there's at least an awareness of where they're coming from. But what I found in my experience is that there's also a problem with even the so-called reasonable center that actually has almost an inbred or an intrinsic bias towards money. I mean, when I have a conversation with someone who is considered, part of the liberal left-leaning media establishment, and they have no awareness that, let's say, 60% of Americans rely on Social Security for over 50% of their income as their retiree, because frankly, everyone they hang out with is far more wealthy. I mean, we have a media class that is far more wealthy than they used to be and don't have an awareness. There's sort of an acceptance that money is and wealth is right in a way. Hello? Hello? Well, I guess that's a conversation ender. I think we've lost. We've had some. We have a technical problem. Let me try and ring him back. We'll just take a. Hello?
Hello?
Hi. Sorry. I think we lost you there.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if you were offended by my question.
No, I wasn't, right? But I thought I gave a great answer. But which question?
I was saying in response to the idea that we have these two different polar sort of media examples between Fox and MSNBC, that I also perceive a problem with our corporate media in general, because you have reporters, whether they're considered even left-leaning or establishment journalists and commentators, who don't seem to have an understanding of what, frankly, American life for people who make less than $70,000 a year is. I've had conversations with establishment media types who think that, you know, the cutting of Social Security is not that big of a deal, with no awareness that over 60% of Americans rely on Social Security for over 50% of their retirement income. And we have a time now where our media has moved into a financial class that I think, for whatever reason, makes them see the world from a wealth perspective.
That's a great point. It actually is consistent with data produced by, you know, political scientists like Mo Fiorini from Stanford, who say that, you know, the perception is America is polarized. America is not polarized. If you do survey attitudes studies of Americans, you know, this very normal Bell distribution, a little bit to the left of where people expect. The people who are polarized are the politically active class, a small subset of Americans who are politically active. They go out and they vote, they engage, they give money to politicians, and they watch MSNBC and Fox News. Those are also affluent people. So those affluent, politically active people become the people to whom politicians speak and to whom media speaks. And so media and politicians who speak to a very small segment of American public because they're the politically engaged sorts, and the rest of the people look at the chattering and think, this is crazy talk. I don't even know what they're talking about here. And so they disengage. So you're right. Again, the media has a political, has an economic incentive to be focusing their energy in this direction. And you know, until we can figure out how to change the economy so that they have an interest in speaking more broadly, I don't think we're going to see any progress.
You know, I wonder, because the other way, based upon the way that you have sort of set this problem up to deal with it, is in some ways to influence the rich, to make them believe it is in their best interests in some way to change the system. I mean, I recently spoke with Chris Hedges, who talks about the death of the liberal class, and that in some ways, because of the traditional pillars of liberalism have become affluent, like you speak, whether it's in academia or within journalism, that it is no longer serving the function of sort of short-circuiting the excesses of capitalism. And
yeah, well, I think you're right. I mean, I just finished a book which is going to be out in October, and the last chapter is titled Rich People. And in Rich People, I sort of describe, you know, this experience I've had of going to very wealthy people and trying to persuade them to come on board with this movement to try to eliminate the salience of money in politics. And a significant number of them sort of look at me and they, you know, kind of recognize why this is a great idea, but they can't imagine giving up the access and influence that they have. You know? Mm-hmm. So they rationalize why it's a good system that where, you know, they get to call the president and talk about welfare reform even though they don't know anything about how poor people live. And then another class of these rich people, you know, are people who are actively working to take away their own power, right? You know, my favorite example of this was we had a pledge of people to promise not to give money to any political candidate who didn't support citizen-funded elections, these small-dollar-funded elections. And people like Edgar Bronfman, you know, who you know, his business, his whole business depends upon, fundamentally depends upon being able to influence politicians. He took the pledge, and he said, I'm not going to support any politician who doesn't support taking away my power, right? And people like Arne Hyatt, who started StrideRight, these are people who are firmly convinced that our democracy is broken because the fat cats control what politicians do. And I think, you know, the real opportunity is if we can get more people on that side to step up and use their resources to basically disempower themselves, we might have a shot at this. But until we get that, I think it's going to be impossible to see how we get this changed.
I know you have to jump, but I just want to ask you one more aspect of that, is that there was, you know, a lot of people, and I think it's widely accepted that the New Deal was a result of a genuine fear in the higher echelons of our society that we may get even a newer and differenter deal, leaning towards socialism or communism. There was a genuine threat to our capitalist system, and that potential for the wealthy elite in this country doesn't exist in the same way because they are so internationalized that the threat of this country imploding, it just doesn't have the same implications to them as it may have 75 years ago.
Well, I agree there's a difference here. I wouldn't say it's just what you've said. It might be part of it. I also think that, you know, we have this weird ideological moment where, you know, Fox News can complain when people are talking about eliminating the Bush tax cuts that we've got class warfare going on. You know, so the Bush tax cuts that the debate was about was tax cuts for the extremely rich, you know, the top 0.1%, not the people making $200,000 a year. You know, we're talking about people making millions of dollars a year, right? So when anybody talks about returning their tax rates to the level they were during the before, you know, during the beginning of the Bush administration, during the Clinton administration, it's class warfare. But when teachers go on strike in Wisconsin to demand collective bargaining rights, and when you know, government employees do the same thing in Wisconsin, then you know, Fox News talks about these people as being greedy,
right.
And so this kind of weird thing where it's verboten to talk class warfare when you're talking about the very rich, but permitted to engage in class warfare against the lower middle class or middle class in America. You know, we've got a political context or political moment that's just very hard to understand, and wouldn't necessarily produce the kind of dynamic that you're talking about, where you know, I think during the New Deal, I do think the very rich thought we have to strike a deal if we're going to avoid something much more dramatic.
Right. I mean, I guess the real question is that will it take a moment of far more protests to convince them of that?
We might see.
All right. Well, Professor Lawrence Lessig, people should visit fixcongressfirst.org to help with what you're doing. I appreciate your time with us today.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye. All right, folks. That's our program for today. You can join me on the flip side at Majority FM. If you can become a member, that would be great. Should we leave in that? Let's leave. I thought that was too funny, actually. I think we're going to have to leave that in. Forgive us for leaving in that little technical difficulty today. It was just too funny. And join us on the flip side, folks, at Majority FM. If you're not a member, well, hell, bye. Oh, okay. Tomorrow we'll have Chris Hayes on the program, and on Friday we'll play that interview with the director of Wasteland. Join me on the flip side on the IM machine if you would.